Yum. And we're back. This is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network, brought to you this week by the Hearst Ranch, 155,000 acres of grass lands, growing grass-fed beef out in California. I'm Katie Kiefer, your host, and today, once again, my co-host Patrick Martins is AWOL. He's out in Kansas City counting turkeys for the turkey season. He's, as I'm sure many of you know, he's the proprietor of Heritage Foods USA, and this is a big season for him. So he is dealing with all of Frank Reese's red bourbon turkeys, and there are about 6,500 of them that have to be inventoried, separated into weight groups, and shipped to various places hither and yon, including Emory University, which just came on as an industrial user of organic turkeys. So that was a great development in the Heritage Foods USA story. So we are in the studio today with Joanna Pruce. And Joanna is the author of at least 10 books that I know of. The most recent is The Griswold and Wagner Ware Cast Iron Cookbook. It is published by Skyhorse Publishing. It is a gorgeous book. Welcome, Joanna.
Thank you
so much for coming. And with Joanna is her husband, Bob Lape, a longtime radio broadcaster and former restaurant critic for Crain's New York. Welcome, Bob. It's a pleasure to have a real live professional radio host in the studio.
Thank you, Katie. It's great to be here.
Listen to those mellifluous tones. Oh, my God.
Practice.
And joining us also is my beloved friend, Rosemarie Morse. Rosemarie and I worked with Joanna years ago on her last book, which was Seduced by Bacon, which I have given as gifts to many, many people, because who does not love bacon? And so anyway, it's a pleasure to have all of you in the studio today. And we're just going to give a little quick overview, right, Joanna, of cast iron cooking and what drew you to, writing a book about this really kind of antique cooking form.
Well, antique it might be. Of course, we know that it's been done in China since before the Christian era. But we also know that in America, in the mid-19th century, when the pioneers were going west in about the 1860s, there were two companies called Griswold and Wagner, and they were the first companies in this country who made exclusively cookware. And when you think of those covered wagons going west, and there was always that chuck wagon.
Oh, yeah.
And oftentimes that clang that you heard, that was the Dutch oven or the skillet.
Uh-huh.
And by the time people got out to the west, they had these giant spiders, these huge skillets with legs. They put them into the fire.
Yeah.
And the point about cast iron is not only has it been around a long time, it doesn't wear out.
That's right. I have cast iron cookware that was my grandmother's easily. And I've always used cast iron cookware because A, it's always been cheap and readily obtainable. And B, I've never found anything that works better than cast iron, to tell you the truth.
You're so right, Katie, because long after we've thrown out all this very fancy cookware, especially the nonstick variety, if you have a seasoned cast iron pan, it's going to keep on going.
Yeah, and it doesn't stick.
It doesn't stick. And as I say to people, go to a yard sale. You can buy them very, very, very inexpensively. You can go to your grandmother's house and maybe just take it from there. She'll probably be happy to have you use it.
She might struggle.
But the point, what I'm saying is I give in very detailed instructions, even if you get one that is really crumbed up.
Oh, I couldn't believe the instructions. You have this guy, the pan man.
Well, he is the veritable
who
expert.
Gives this totally radical method in which you, I mean, I was just like, whoa, man, I don't know if I want to do that to my cast iron. Of course, I don't have to because I use it all the time. But if I had found a really rusty piece,
yep.
And he says that what you need to do is wear rubber gloves and eye protection.
Well, because you're using toxic stuff.
Yeah, he suggests that you initiate the cleaning process by spraying the pan with oven cleaner, yep, and putting it in a plastic bag for several days. Radical.
Well, radical, but you know what? How many pans have we thrown out along the way and really polluted our environment? If you can get something for $5 and you do this. Now, most pans are not in that condition. Most pans simply need re-seasoning.
Yeah.
This man is called David G. Smith. He is called, his website is panman.com.
Yeah, he's a trader. He's a trader in cast iron cookware.
Well, he's a trader. He's an expert for Wagner.
Mm-hmm.
And between David Smith and Joel Schiff, I had lots of antique information that came to me. And I think that's part of what gives this book its flavor, that people see these old ads, they get very excited, and there are so many old stories in here, because when we started doing this, I think the book was already done. Was it true we went to Roberto's? And this chef is so charming, and he said,
little restaurant in Edgewater,
New Jersey. Yeah, tell him about that. It was just...
Well, Roberto's, too, is a father-son team, and the second Roberto is now full-time chef in this place on River Road in Edgewater, and the place has been there for 35 years or so. But we were enjoying an evening's meal there. It's sort of my Italian restaurant away from home in New Jersey, because I once lived there.
Uh-huh.
And we discovered, as we were chatting with him about cast iron, a story about his grandma. Was it his wife's mother?
Yes. No, his mother's mother.
His mother's mother. Do you take it from there, because you know the recipe?
No, it was just very, very, very sweet. And he told us the story that his mother's mother, who was a single woman, a seamstress, had two young girls. Her name was La Rosa, her last name. And she would make a meatloaf in the morning. She would form it with, she'd soak bread in milk, like a lot of old people did, add it with ground beef with some seasonings, and she formed it into a large flat patty, probably no thicker than 2 inches.
Mm-hmm.
And she left that in the morning. And she came home, and she was able to make this dinner in a skillet for her two daughters within a half an hour.
Wow.
She added some stock and some mushrooms to it. And it was beyond delicious. I was so surprised. Actually, I was so surprised by a lot of dishes when I was working my way through that I've said that you should adopt all these pans, by the way, from all these yard sales, because they all come with stories that are so poignant and so wonderful. And the other thing is cooking in cast iron, in case you don't know it, there's a tiny bit of iron that is leached into the food.
Yeah.
And it staves off anemia. There's nobody in our grandparents' generation that had iron poor blood. So in any case, there were just all these wonderful discoveries, among which were Bob's mother's, he called her Mammy Lape, her roast beef. And I grew up in California, and to me, roast beef was prime ribs. It was served rare to medium rare with the potatoes roasted in the pan, and that was it.
Bob's shaking his head.
Bob is shaking his head because his daughter, Deb, told me that you have to get this. It's about a 4 or 5 pound piece of chuck, it turns out to be, and you sear it off. And then you cook it in a Dutch oven with nothing more than one onion stuck with a clove, a carrot, and a piece of celery for 5 hours. You turn it after 2.5 hours at 325 or 350 degrees. You then take it out. You throw out any fat that comes out, with the exception of about 2 tablespoons. You add a couple tablespoons of flour. You add stock, and then the surprise for me is you add milk. Now, let me tell you, I had never heard of milk gravy until...
Milk gravy.
Yeah, very, very Pennsylvania Dutch
in
its origins.
Yeah.
And very Southern.
Yes, I was going to say, I always associate it with Southern.
Does the milk curdle?
No, not at all.
Not like in the Italian, like that Italian pork roast dish.
You do have to stir it with some frequency, though.
But, you know, the amazing thing is, I served it to a friend of mine called Maura Sullivan, who's from a big Irish family, and I put it over thick noodles, and everybody went nuts. And I went, and then we served it. Bob said they had it with mashed potatoes.
The only
difference is, apparently, in the Lape family, there was never enough gravy, so I upped the quantity of liquid. And
that was always a problem in my family, too.
And people ask me, did you take the recipes exactly as they were? And probably one of the staggeringly most successful recipes in this book is my mom's mac and cheese. And more people have swooned about it. It also has bacon in it, so.
How could it not be good?
Well, how could, and that's how my mom got the 5 kids up in the morning. She made 1.5 pounds of bacon every day. But we didn't need alarm clocks. But the reality is, my mom did not have panko, and the Parmesan cheese probably would have been from that green cylinder.
Kraft.
Exactly. So what I did is I took old recipes and I tweaked where possible. I got rid of chemicals if there were any of those.
Uh-huh.
And I just made it better. And I lived off of the memories. I lived off my mom's best friend, Peggy. We used to call her Aunt Peggy. She made a tamale pie because I grew up in Los Angeles.
I remember my mother used to make that a lot, too.
I just loved it.
It was a great, cheap dish.
Mm-hmm. You know what? And what I did in that case is I got rid of the second crust of cornmeal.
Too much.
I also added chipotles, which didn't exist, you know, when we were growing. I mean, I'm sure they existed, but we didn't have them.
Yeah, they certainly weren't available in your local supermarket.
No. But a lot of this stuff now is. And
oh, my God, the way things have changed in supermarkets. Well, I often touch on that in this show because I regularly invite somebody who runs a small supermarket chain or something like that to talk about the changes in the way people perceive food and how consumers buy now as opposed to the way they did 15 years ago before all of these things like chipotles and adobo sauce became available in every supermarket, no matter how upscale or low scale.
Absolutely. And, you know, I found out, for example, when I was growing up, in Los Angeles, my mom had Lowry's Season Salt.
Yeah, we had that.
And it was invented, I suppose, around 1938.
It was always on hard-boiled eggs.
Deviled eggs, too.
Yeah.
But I discovered along the way, my mom used to make this potted chicken, and it was just, it meant my mom was cooking. And the amazing thing is when
don't
I found...
Don't cry, Joanne.
No. But the interesting thing about it was I discovered... I do. You know, my mom's going to be 94.
Oh, you're so lucky.
And the thing is that I discovered that this Lowry salt at that point had MSG.
Yes.
And I am horrendously allergic to MSG. So thank God for modern conveniences. I went on the internet and I found a copycat deconstructed version of Lowry salt.
Yeah, I saw that in the book. I plan to copy that myself.
And then I took the other ingredients my mom would have put in it. And the first time I smelled it, I thought, oh my God, I'm back in my mom's kitchen.
Oh,
and that's what's
lovely.
So fun. Yeah.
Let me ask you, aside from getting recipes from Mammy Lape and from your own mother and friends like Aunt Peggy, like where else did you source your recipes from? Because you actually have a really interesting and eclectic, I loved your clam and corn fritter recipe because having grown up in Rhode Island, there's that Kenyon's Johnny Cake meal and Kenyon's clam fritter meal. And so clam fritters are a big part of my, you know, childhood growing up, and we always made them with fresh corn off the cob, and you know,
sure.
I still make them actually. We made them this summer.
Well, there's a funny story about that also because I recently did a charity dinner where I was, we work for Cancer Care for Kids, and two couples bought the opportunity to come to our house for a substantial amount of money. And I was talking to one gentleman and I said, well, let's talk about your menu. And I said, I just finished this book about cast iron comfort food. And he goes, nah, he said, it's not really ringing my bell. And I said, okay, I did do a book about wild game with D'Artagnan. And he goes, you're getting better. I said, well, how about I do venison Wellington with foie gras? And he goes, man, you're just ringing all the bells.
Wow.
So I said, okay.
Intonabulation of the bells.
So in the meantime, what I did was I said, well, I told him that some of the dishes I would make, but I made these corn and clam fritters as a first course, as an appetizer. And of all the dishes I made, now, mind you, they love the venison Wellington, but everybody went berserk about that.
I can imagine.
And you know why? It's like a lot of the food in this dish. It harkens back to simpler, kinder times.
Yeah.
And it's actually from my mom. She used to make corn fritters.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And so there's a lot of food that I was inspired by what I've encountered over the years. I first encountered paella, for example, when I was living in Paris. My aunt had a Portuguese cook. But the other thing that happened is I discovered that paella and jambalaya, for example, are first cousins.
Practically identical.
Oh, yeah. And I love the connectivity. There's a woman who's a banker in New York, and she made Korean short ribs. Now, my short ribs have bourbon and molasses, and hers have very Asian ingredients. But I like showing those connections. I think that, you know, we may be American, but we are who we've known in the past and whose paths we've crossed. And so really what I wanted was simpler foods. There's a lot of very fancy chefs, by the way, who are using cast iron because as kitchens have evolved at home, people are returning to their home kitchen. And they want to be able to serve it straight from the oven or the stovetop to the family.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we certainly did. One of the things I really loved about the book were the little nuggets of wisdom from Aunt Ellen, who was the write-in spokesperson for, I guess, Griswold?
And 40 years.
40 years. I mean, and they have these wonderful pictures of her with the sort of bun on top and the fluffy collar, and she's holding her casserole. It's too cute. And she says, and then one of the beginnings of one of your sections, the seductive smells from such a kitchen sent a summons sharp as bells. portly smells from guinea hens soaked in wine juice, birds broiling over ashes, white onions stewing in a ruddy pan. They made life genial for the eating. I mean, we don't talk about food that way anymore. Yeah. No. I just loved that.
Only wine writers describing the flavors of wines come up with that.
Exactly. I just found that totally enchanting. And then she had so many wonderful tips, and they're great. I mean, really, this book has to be seen to be truly appreciated, because not only is the photography and the food styling just beautiful, thanks to Joanna, who can... actually shot all of the food had a photographer shoot it.
There is a photographer.
But you're a food stylist, right?
I was a food stylist, but the photographer is called Batman.
I know him. We worked on a project with Batman.
I think we did.
Alan Bat.
Alan Bat. Yeah, he's great. He's
a wonderful guy. I loved him. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so wonderful, because he came to the house, as Bob said, we did them all within a couple of days. And that's because we didn't gussy up the food. We just we did it as it came out of the oven. And somebody had said to me the other day, it looks like it's really real food.
Yeah.
I said, guess what? We ate it all.
Well, what's amazing is that you did it over the course of 2 days. And, managed
that was Herculean.
Herculean. There's a lot of recipes. How many recipes are in the book?
90.
90, yeah. That's a lot of food to process.
Well, we did 2 days of shooting. You do a lot of prep, and I've been doing this stuff for a long time. But I do want to mention Leanna Weller Smith, who was the art director on the book, and without
fabulous
a doubt,
job.
My editor Anne Treisman. I've worked with her on 4 books, and it makes it easier when you trust each other. You know that you're, and I think it was such a great collaboration. I was lucky. I worked very hard on it. But, you were asking about how do you produce a book like this. And I think today it's a lot different than when I first started writing cookbooks.
Yeah.
Much faster.
Let's take a short break, and we'll come right back with Joanna Pruess and Bob Laip and Rosemary Morse, and we'll talk a little bit more about cast iron cooking and book promotion. Back with the main course on Heritage Radio Network. This show is sponsored by the Hearst Ranch. We are in the back of Roberta's Pizza at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And my guests today are Joanna Pruess and her husband Bob Laip and Rosemary Morse. And we're talking about Joanna's newest book, Cast Iron, the Griswold and Wagner Ware Cast Iron Cookbook, which is just coming out this month from Skyhorse Publishing. So Joanna, let's talk a little bit about, because Rosemary and I worked for years doing publicity, and we worked on your last book, Seduced by Bacon, together. And so let's talk a little bit about how things have changed in the way from when you wrote your first book 20 years ago to how you promote a book in this day and age. Because even in the short time that I did publicity, things changed radically. And I've been out of the game now for about 2 years, I guess.
Yes, and they've changed radically. Radically,
come closer to your mic, beautiful.
Then.
Yeah. Well, Rosemary, even since you and I worked together.
Oh my goodness! I mean, it's gotten to be so much harder.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't know if it's gotten so much harder. It's it's become very different, because now we have the internet, fewer newspapers, fewer editors. At the papers where, Katie and I used to pitch, half of the food editors are gone.
Yeah.
But now they're freelancers, or they do stuff on the web. So then you have to figure out where all these people are, and then they will write in on food websites. But I think that, you know, when I used to make 50 phone calls and get 2 hits, now you have to make 100 phone calls and maybe get the 2 hits or 1 hit. You can't stop and you can't get discouraged, but it is discouraging. It's tough out there.
So, Joanna, what have you done that's different for this book than previous books?
I think I'm taking a very proactive position, right. Yeah. Along with my husband. I actually went out and I bought 500 books.
Right.
And it's fine that people buy them on Amazon. It's fine that they buy them at their local bookstore. But the thing I feel, there's two things. Number one, very bluntly, financially, it's more advantageous for me to sell them.
Yeah, of course.
Second, I have an emotional connection, and I can see who's buying the books, and I can talk about them. And third of all, there are all kinds of different venues. For example, I'm doing a couple of book signings up at Yonkers Raceway at the Empire Diner section.
Empire City.
Mm-hmm.
So what made you pick that venue?
A friend of ours.
Do they have cast iron cookware there?
No, but what they do have is they have special events, and they have a very creative publicist.
Uh-huh.
And we were having lunch with him, and he said, wow, this seems like a really good idea. And I think that for people who want to be in the book business today, who want to be book writers, you have to look at all kinds of venues. I'm doing something at my local library in Yonkers, and where I've said, I will sell the book retail, and I'll give $5 to charity to the library,
uh-huh.
Or in another case, to feed the hungry. And you really have to look at all the different opportunities. You're right about being online. It's amazing. If you forget the blogs, for example, there was a fabulous, fabulous interview by a man who does a cast iron blog.
Yeah, that was very good.
And I was
he did a really nice job.
He did. He's called Rick Mansfield, mm-hmm. And I've had wonderful reactions. I've had reactions on Amazon as a result of that.
So, did he find you, or did you find him?
He found me.
No kidding.
Yep. So you really have to look. You have to be awake and. Whereas I would, in past, with the exception of bacon, everybody loved bacon, and I
and
did
it. Guys.
Yeah, and thanks to you guys. Yeah, we did. Yeah, I did a CBS morning segment, it was supposed to be 3 minutes. It was on pecan brown sugar and bacon ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Which and was it, phenomenal.
but it went on for 7 minutes, and everybody was fighting about it. It was very funny. but it's fun because, you know, whereas before, in the first, you know, 7-8 books, I knew I had done a book, but now every time I do have books with me, and people say, oh, you have a book, and they say, I'd like your book. I go to my gym, and people say, oh, I heard you wrote a book. So it's a little, you just have to be very proactive.
I go to my doctor and tell him about the latest Joanna production. He says, oh, I'd like one of those. I go to the car and get him
and
one
get
of
it.
Those. Well, get even somehow.
I think this is the way to do it. I'm often asked by authors to do public relations, and I said, look, I can do a bit of this, but you have to do the rest, and you have to be aware of the fact that this is your baby. Nobody's as interested in your baby as you are. So you have to talk to all your friends. You have to remember the friends that you had 20 years ago. You have to remember your aunt, your mother, your grandmother, whoever you know. You have to let them know you have a book. Some people object to the fact that they have to do their own publicity or use their own friends. And I said, wait a second. Those are the people who are most likely to buy your book, most likely to be interested. So why don't you go with your strengths? And also, for people that know people on the internet, go on the internet, go into their website, compliment them on their book, and then they will repay you by doing the same for you. So it's really a tit-for-tat, you know, game, and it's essential.
Joanna, let me ask you this. Since you've been in the business for so long and you've written, you know, 10 books over the last 20 years, how much of an impact or how much have things changed since the Food Network started promoting its on-camera talent as cookbook authors? Because I think that's had an enormous impact on people who don't have a television show, and it has really created a much tougher market for people, even as accomplished and as well-known as you are, to sell your books to, you know, big publishing houses.
I agree with you 100%. But I do think what's happening is there's a division. between celebrity chefs and people who are still making cookbooks that people just relate to. And the only experience I can say is that when I did a book signing the other night for a group I belong to, and people, one woman bought a box of 14. She's Great. Giving them its Christmas presents. We have another friend who's buying four cases because it's an instantly accessible book. I said, sure, I'll sign it. But at first I got kind of dispirited, and I said, you know, this is really depressing. I'm not a celebrity of the ilk of these restaurant chefs. But then all of a sudden it's like a groundswell. People are getting so interested in comfort food, in things that are approachable. This happens to be a remarkably reasonably priced book that is gorgeous.
It is gorgeous.
And the food, I mean, one dish after another. In that interview, Rick asked me, well, which are some of your favorite recipes? And I said, the problem is, it's like asking a mother to choose her favorite children, because these are recipes I love. And, I mean, there's a raspberry blackberry crisp in there.
I know, that looks delicious.
And it's a no-brainer. I mean, you go in the South, there are all these crisps. It takes no effort. And you serve it in a black skillet. And people go
crazy. And
it looks
great.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things I liked a lot about the recipes was that they are really quite easy to make. Like, you had a couple of pizza recipes, for instance, where you buy the dough, and if you want to, you can buy the sauce or make your own. But the point is that you make a really lovely, you know, accessible dinner. It takes about a half an hour to put it together, and it's served, and it looks delicious.
It's amazingly tasty. Joanna, as we say in our family, Joanna's the green lady, and I'm the fried guy. So when you talk to me about a vegetarian pizza, my blood pressure doesn't rise very fast.
Yeah.
But this one, with artichoke hearts and things, was just
great.
Delicious. I just loved it to pieces. I was in the uniquely favorable position of getting to taste everything. And very few of those recipes, I could count on, I think, on the fingers of one hand,
which ones are
real
they?
Working over. I mean, the ones that needed to be repeated until she got it the way she wanted it. Many of them really came out of the box, were terrific to taste. We're not talking about calories here at all. And I must say, one of the things, I've been reviewing food books for 30 years.
Yeah.
And so I see a lot of
and
them.
Food.
Yeah, and food as well. But I am pleased in this book with the number of people who get the book and report back in a day or two that I sat up last night. I've been reading a lot of that book, and I want to eat every single
recipe. I know, I read the whole thing last night.
Yeah. It's that kind of a book.
Yeah,
you know,
it's very
fun
charming.
And it tickles the taste buds.
Yeah, and plus all of the graphics are so well chosen. I mean, the old ads and the Aunt Ellen's tips and stuff like that. I mean, it really brings you back to another era of cooking. And, of course, anybody who likes to cook typically has a library of old cookbooks, and part of the charm of that is not so much the dishes themselves but the copy that goes with them. So it's really nice to have this very sort of contemporary take on food, but the nice sort of old-timey qualities that go along with the medium of cast iron. So
chefs like Tom Colicchio, Guy Fieri, these are your guys from the Food Network.
Yeah.
They both put blurbs on the back of the book.
I saw that,
because
they
both said, yep, this is where it's happening. And I didn't want it to be super arch. I mean, there are a couple of dishes that are contemporary, seared swordfish over oriental noodles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite is seared steak and stout, where you just put the steak in the stout along with a little apple cider vinegar and brown sugar for 20 minutes. And you saute off tons of onions. Then you strain the marinade over the onions after the onions are brown. And it just glazes them, and you have this wonderful flavor.
It sounds like sort of a sauerbraten almost. Like a,
well, but then you have...
Or the flamand. Flemish is carbonade.
It is good. Well, you have that in the onions, but then you have this wonderful, crunchy, rare steak.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, delicious.
Oh, my God. It is wonderful.
Yeah. That sounds great. I would make that. Maybe I'll do it for dinner tonight.
Well, try it. It's super easy. One of the big discoveries was pozole. I know Bob just fell in love with it.
I love pozole. Yeah.
And this came from a friend of ours, Pam Harding, Pam and John Harding, who are just wonderful cooks. And it was so Native American and so classic, and yet we sat there eating it like, oh, God, this is so good. This is so good. When I answered your question, we did have friends who said, I have a great recipe.
Uh-huh.
And they gave it to us. And then there's a wonderful Sicilian beef in there, a remarkably talented chef. And it's beef stew that just goes on, but it's cooked with orange juice and orange zest.
Oh, I saw that.
Oh, man. one is that?
That looked amazing. Yeah.
And it tastes very Sicilian. You've got cinnamon in it. And
yes.
And, good.
Yeah, it really, and tomato, but all these Sicilian flavors. And that, too, is the connection. You know, there we all find, I think lots of people have found something to connect to in this book.
Yeah, absolutely. So well, that Southern Italian flavor spectrum comes from North Africa.
Of course it does.
So you, I mean, I've always been interested in Southern Italian cooking for that reason, because it does unite so many of those different flavors in a way that is, you know, not specifically African food. It's really almost more of, you know, something that we've all sort of grown up with to a certain degree. I mean, the use of capers or sweet and sour, agro dolce. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are flavor combinations that are just, you know, sort of universal. What was that, you guys?
Yeah. Sounds like a bee got
somebody's
inside there.
Somebody's cell phone.
Somebody's cell phone. Uh-oh.
You know, the thing is, as you said earlier, there's just so much more available to us today.
Yeah, absolutely.
And especially in regards to pizza, because we go to our local pizzeria and ask and just buy the dough.
Mm-hmm.
I would not recommend you buy the kind that some supermarkets that it basically is white bread. You do have to read, and that's what I say about everything. Anything you buy convenience or anything you buy for yourself, read what's in it. But the other side is you can make a great pizza really easily this way.
Yeah, really easily, like in about 15 minutes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Those recipes were so simple. The one that looked like it took a little work was bigos, which is a dish that I absolutely adore. I used to live next door to a Polish woman, and periodically this is the only dish she knew how to make. And she would make a huge amount of it, because I don't think it's really possible
to
make
small quantities. The national dish of Poland, yes.
And it's got, you know, tons of different kinds of pork and sausage and meat and cabbage and sauerkraut. And it was this extraordinary mishmash, but it had that sweetness, mm-hmm. either given she put
prunes.
Apples in hers, but you put prunes in yours, which I thought was a much better idea.
Well, and bigos, as you say, it's also like bratwurst and sauerkraut in the Midwest.
It is,
But, I mean, for me, bigos came along when I had a Polish artisan who was restoring the wood in my dining room.
Mm.
Okay? And unfortunately, as these things go, it took forever and ever and ever. And he brought this as a peace offering.
Yeah.
But it is something that does cook a long time.
But it's kind of like a choucroute, too.
Yes, it is.
So it's sort of the same idea as that, although you put fresh cabbage in a choucroute, typically. Mm. But it was, again, it's like the interconnectedness of how food evolves along sort of geographic lines. You know, from Poland down to Germany, you have this, and from Alsace.
Yeah. You're getting buzzed again.
Yeah, we're getting buzzed again.
Well, and you're not even drinking.
Don't count on that, Joanna.
Okay, well, sorry about that. Yeah. But you know what? I love that. I love the idea that what's old is new. I love the idea that basically we have wonderful ingredients available to us today, and you don't have to gussy them up. You can just add simple little tiny things. They look pretty. You can take them from your
herbs.
And it's important mentioning about cast iron that, with the exception of the microwave, because you can't put a cast iron in a microwave, but you can do every other kind of cooking, and you can start on a very high heat if you want to sear there's swordfish, and it simmers beautifully. The best fried chicken in the history of the world.
Absolutely.
And all of this is available. And because most cast iron, the traditional cast iron, does not have a wood handle, it can go in a very hot oven.
Yes.
And you don't have to worry about anything happening to it. And it's worth mentioning, however, cast iron is virtually indestructible unless you take that hot pan and put it under some cold water.
Yeah, you don't want to do that.
And that makes a big boink.
Yeah.
And then you do have a deconstructed cast iron.
Yes, you don't want to do that. But aside from that, there's really almost nothing you can do to cast iron to wreck it. It's really, I mean, even if you destroy your seasoning, which I often do, because the way I clean my cast iron is give it a swab and then put it on the stove to dry over a flame, right? Because I don't want it to rust.
Right.
And then I walk away and I leave the flame on. And about 10 minutes later, I'm... What is that smell?
I'm cooking some more iron.
Yeah, you know, it's my red hot iron.
Here's my tip about that. They say that David Smith talks about putting a very thin layer of fat on it.
Mm-hmm.
I had a cube of Crisco in the freezer,
mm-hmm.
and I use that cube of just to rub it over the surface,
sure.
a very thin layer, and then put it back in the stove. I have never found a better way to season it. Yeah. So that works real well for me. Not the one that's butter flavored, just the straight Crisco.
The straight old Crisco. Yeah, yeah, because the thing is that using something like canola oil or something like that, it gets kind of gummy.
It puddles.
You really don't want to do that.
That's absolutely true.
You want to use an animal fat or one of those hydrogenated things that you're not supposed to eat anymore, but which really do work very well.
Yeah, but we've repatriated lard, for example. It's suddenly we know it's not so bad for us.
It turns out it's really good for you. Yeah.
It does. I mean, if you really, the flavor.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's the only way to make pie crust, as far as I'm concerned, is with a half a pound of lard and 3 cups of flour. That's about it.
Yeah.
And an egg yolk.
It's interesting. We first, I think, saw the renaissance of at least the small cast iron pans. And a lot of contemporary restaurants, I think of Kraft, I think of the BLT, Laurent Turandel's restaurants, all these side dishes started appearing in small cast iron pans, which Joanna used to great good effect on a dessert that sort of goes almost over the top.
Oh, that was your chocolate chip cookie sundae thing? Yeah, that looked outrageous.
Yes. I think I brought you some of the salted caramel.
Oh, bless your heart, girlfriend. I can't wait to sample that.
It's a fresh chocolate chip cookie finished off in that little pan and topped with vanilla ice cream and this salted caramel sauce that she makes.
Oh, my God.
My heavens.
Yeah, that sounds really great.
Somebody was saying, we were talking about what you could use it for. And well, we said we could put it on apples, we could put it on pretzels. And she said, listen, let's just cut to the chase and put it on our fingers. It's pretty addictive.
Yeah, it sounds great.
Yeah, there's also individual cast iron skillet cornbread.
I saw that. That was a very attractive looking little presentation, too. That's really a fancy little thing. And you could do little tiny frittatas, too, in your...
Frittatas. Yeah. And we have a friend also, the Harneys from Harney Tea. Mm-hmm. And what Elise did is she has a big family, and she has a 6-burner stove. She gives all the kids an individual skillet for their eggs.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's pretty fun that way.
It is fun. So we're going to take a break in about a minute, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit more about, both promotion and also the changing restaurant scene and how your type of cast iron cookware is morphing into what people are eating in restaurants, because Bob can talk to us about that. Thanks. This is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. This is your host, Katie Kiefer. My co-host, Patrick Martins, is away this week counting turkeys. Nevertheless, we are still sponsored by the Hearst Ranch, even when Patrick's not here. We are engineered today by Nat Wiener and produced by Jack Inslee. Thanks, guys. And my guests today are Joanna Pruse with her fantastic new cookbook, The Griswold and Wagnerware Cast Iron Cookbook. Her husband, Bob Lape, a former restaurant critic for Crane's and still restaurant critic for WCBS. as well as a frequent reviewer of cookbooks and just general all-around knowledgeable dude about the food industry. And my beloved friend Rosemary Morris and former working colleague. We were talking a little bit about what it takes to promote a book these days. And we'll be talking about that some more in the next hour when we have Henry Zook from Book Court on. But for now, let's talk a little bit about how comfort food and stuff like what, you know, the recipes such as the ones that are in the Cast Iron Cookware book are kind of making their way into the restaurant world. We're sort of, Bob, I think you're probably the best qualified to talk about this, but just the way things are traveling from that super fancy, the whole sort of Nouvelle precious thing from the 80s and early 90s.
We're pretty much out of that now.
We're out of that now.
Yes, we
so
are.
What are you seeing most of now in the restaurant world?
You are seeing small plates. You are seeing comfort food, whether you call these things tapas or whatever you call them. But small plates, small items, mix and match dishes. We were in Trestle on 10th last night, the night before, which is a restaurant of maybe 4 years old now. But it is a place where you can go and order any one of their four or five appetizers, or you can go into their charcuterie department and have some cheeses, some pâtés, and then you get on to they're doing some duck necks, and they do have a few entrees, perhaps a half
duck
a dozen.
Duck necks?
Yeah.
Oh. Why do I want to eat a duck neck?
They were breaded.
Were they
crispy,
great?
Crunchy, crusty. Oh. And they were very tasty. Served with like a creamy Dijon sauce, which was nice.
They were served with an aioli.
The prices are down. That's the other thing. In the obvious economy-driven situation that we are in now, you got to go down. You got to increase the public perception of value, however you do that.
Yeah.
And you got to give them enough to eat and enough freedom to dip around, taste here, taste there, taste a lot of things. And as I say, the move back to comfort, it's almost cliche to say that we've gone there because we have to, because it's the only safe place for our heads, maybe our stomachs, I don't know. But we are deep in that. Comfort food is very much in. And it's an interesting time. The new restaurants that are opening, there are only a few really big deal, big ticket restaurants where someone has spent several millions of dollars to open them. But it's often something like Tony May and Marissa May's SD26, where they move San Domenico down to 26th Street in Madison Square Park. But this is a wide open young restaurant with a lot of little dishes. And again, you mix and match whatever turns your...
It makes me think of Bill Telepan, who, when he first opened Telepan on the Upper West Side, had four items. Remember, he had that intermediate course, and he took a real beating in the press over that. But really, from his perspective, it was like, well, maybe you don't want a full-size entree. Maybe you want to get two or three little plates before you go to the dessert course. And he was one of the first, I think, that offered that kind of flexibility. And it's interesting how prescient he was now that I look back on it, because he's actually ridden out this economic slump quite well.
Yes, he has.
And I think largely because, he's a terrific guy. And I think largely because he was smart enough to see that this trend was the one that was really starting to percolate. And he was one of the first, I think, to capitalize on it.
Yeah, but Tom Colicchio, when he opened Kraft.
When he opened Kraft, he had that too.
And this was a long time before Bill Telepan got to it. He had the little plates. In other words, you could make your own dinner.
Well, yeah, but you still had to order from an entree, and then you ordered your side dishes. He didn't have that intermediate course the way Bill had, and that, I think, was what was really unusual.
But then if you didn't want to have the main
thing, you didn't have to
have
a potato if you didn't. Right, right. That's true.
You could just have the side dishes.
And he was producing them in those little beautiful little copper skillet.
Speaking about side dishes,
end of the woods mushrooms and
but you know what, that's what I was going to say, but Tom has done Brussels sprouts. I do Brussels sprouts
with
bacon.
That beautiful recipe with bacon,
bacon and pistachios. And if you've never had oven roasted asparagus, you are in for such a treat, because oftentimes asparagus are just watery and I think almost chemical flavored. And these just are earthy and delicious.
And they caramelize.
Vibrant, green. Yeah. They're just so amazing. And I think that's the discovery. I think people want flavor.
Yeah.
And I think what you're saying, people want comfort food, but they don't want to have to intellectualize their food. But if you can get great asparagus, and you can even buy at your local supermarket and just cook them this way, and Wow. And the same thing with Brussels sprouts. When I was growing up, I thought Brussels sprouts were just anathema.
Smelly vegetable.
Yeah.
Disgusting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wouldn't have touched one.
Yeah. But when you do
I still have a hard time with them, actually.
Well, I'm going to ask you to try them this way. Yeah, they're just pretty darn terrific.
Yeah. I can imagine doing that recipe with them shredded, which was the way that I found it the most palatable was my mother discovered shredding them about 15 years ago, and then they were really pretty good.
Yeah. I stir fry them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's when they're cooked for too long
sulfur.
In that water.
Sulfur. It's
that's
awful.
Yeah, it's bad news.
Yeah, it is. It's like going down the hall in Grandma's apartment.
Well, yeah, it was cabbage in my case.
Well, it's the same thing. Whoa. A little mini.
Well, I like to remind everyone of Barbara Kafka's book on roasting, which for a while was, you know, very, very popular. But the point is, she really started a trend, and one of the best ways of eating cabbage that I learned from Kafka is to actually take a cabbage, chop it any old way you want to, put a little olive oil or what lard or whatever you want, and you can take a cast iron skillet and put it in the oven, very hot oven.
Yeah.
And by the time you pull it out of the oven, you don't know quite what you're eating, but you're eating something crisp and utterly delicious.
It's true. It
and
is a great way of
cooking
cabbage. Yeah.
And so anything you can put in the oven.
You can do that with cauliflower too, actually.
Oh, yes.
That's
divine.
Fabulous.
Divine. And all of them work wonderfully in cast iron.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've done that with cauliflower a lot, where you just slice the whole head into big, thick slices and fry it in the, you know.
We had that too. But both my grandmothers were born on Christmas.
Really?
But one of my grandmother's mother was Austro-Hungarian, and one of her favorite treats was cabbage strudel.
Oh, yeah.
And it is because the cabbage, the root vegetables, have residual sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And if you cook it with onions and you slowly saute it, brown it off, and you put it in strudel. I used to always make it for her birthday and Christmas.
Joanna, in my cooking lesson last week, we did a class on polenta, and we made a polenta lasagna with cabbage, cooked exactly as you describe, and then roasted in the oven baked in the oven with a lot of fontina. It was unbelievable.
It's fabulous. The other thing you can do with that, with the cabbage strudel or with your polenta, is put wild mushrooms in it.
Yeah.
And the Hungarians, God love them, they also put raisins and had a slightly sweet version of it, too.
Nice.
Yeah, there used to be a Mrs. Herb Strudel on the Upper East Side, and before I was making it, I was stopping there and bringing it to my grandmother.
How interesting that she would put raisins in, because there you go back to that sort of Sicilian idea. I don't think of the Austro-Hungarian Empire as particularly being connected to that southern.
Oh, yes.
Well, they
did it with walnuts. You have those rolls at Christmas time.
Yeah.
Walnut rolls and poppy seed rolls. And definitely you put raisins in there, blonde raisins or dark raisins. Yeah, it's very much part of it.
Yeah.
Says my resident Croatian.
Well, see.
Yes, but you're right. But you know where else it goes back to? It goes back to the Ottoman Empire, because it all came up there. That way.
Absolutely.
And there was the connection.
Food history is so much fun.
Oh, I love it.
It's one of my favorite things to read up on. Absolutely.
And you're right. Poppy seed strudel.
Mm.
She called it makoshretish.
Mak. Yep. That's right.
And
in Serbo-Croat, you call it makovnjača.
Well, and hers was makoshretish, and she'd get this faraway look in her eyes. And, you know, the funny thing is, though, I wrote an article about seeds at one point. And my big fear when I would have that is I'd get a seed in my teeth, you see. And I remember going out and smiling and somebody I thought I wanted to like. And I had a seed in my tooth.
Oh, yeah. They're deadly that
Those
way.
Those moments.
Absolutely.
But, you know.
But I took her anyhow.
Yeah, right. But you know what? They actually... Paprika Weiss. Ed Weiss explained to me.
I remember that store.
Yeah,
and
that store.
His grandfather or father, I think it was his grandfather, came over with Hungarian paprika, and all the mudyars on the Upper East Side would yell, "Paprika, Paprika Weiss." He explained to me that the Hungarians predominantly used yellow raisins because he said aesthetically they didn't like the dark color in their food. And I thought, wow, isn't that interesting?
Well, it's prettier, I think, to see the yellow together with the poppy seed if you put black on black.
But it sure tasted good.
And, you know, same thing, you know, with the walnuts. I think it's prettier to see the yellow.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I would agree.
Yeah.
Well, dark raisins have their place in sort of darker colored foods, right, like carrot cake or something like that. Yeah. But it's true. I mean, if you're going to use it in a pasta dish or some sort of light colored thing, it's really, it's, you know, it looks a little scary, actually.
But now that paprika rice has disappeared, you can go to Sahadi in Brooklyn.
Sure.
Or you can go to Kalustian in Manhattan.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Or you go online.
And that's
true. That is, we're talking about what is today's world about.
Yeah.
And
the world of food is absolutely incredible online, isn't it?
There is an absolutely charming story about a friend of ours. He and his wife are jewelers, called Cahan's. And they're on the Upper East Side. And as we were going through this book, Stephen said, man, our housekeeper used to make the most fabulous fried chicken. Well, of course, fried chicken in a cast iron pan is great. He said, Hattie, their housekeeper, used to skin the chicken, soaked it in buttermilk.
Yes.
Rolled it in cornflakes, which a lot of people, it turns out, have heard. But she had Parmesan cheese. We're talking about 60 years ago at least.
Wow.
All right. So off I set. And he said she baked it.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, all of this sort of had a modern, old feel to it.
Definitely.
There is a website called foodtimeline.com. And I've been in touch with this woman several times. And she said, Joanna, that kind of recipe appeared in a newspaper article about 60 years ago, that it was already old, that cornflakes must have done that already.
Yeah, Kellogg's must have done it when they were starting to market cereals around the turn of the century.
And that people had done that. And so you feel like you're such a sleuth. Well, guess what? Maybe that's where they got it, from the back of a cornflakes box. And it does turn out to be wonderfully delicious fried chicken. I did put both versions, the real,
I saw that, yeah.
Knock your socks off one of it. But this one is quite delicious. And so I was able to do, thanks to the modern world, I was able to research and check out the story. And I could say to him, guess what? This is probably where Hattie got her fried chicken from.
Fantastic.
It's kind of fun, though, huh?
Yeah. I took a course last year at the New School with Andy Smith, who's a food historian, and had a blast talking about how sort of food has changed over the last 150 years, the industrialization of food. That was the name of the course. And then Andy's been on the show, actually, a couple times to both promote books, and also he's coming back in a couple weeks for Thanksgiving to talk about why we eat what we eat for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
What is the genesis of that American Thanksgiving feast, which includes, whatever it includes, but, things like green beans and canned cream of mushroom soup. I didn't eat that, but I know most people do, and there's a whole raft of dishes, the sweet potatoes with marshmallows on top. Where the hell did that come from? I mean, who thought that one up?
It's better with bacon, though.
Everything is better with bacon, Joanna.
I know. How long will Joanna's book be in Kansas City?
I think he was actually flying back today.
Okay, then I can't give him a restaurant recommendation there.
But I think he has to go back, actually, because he's not going to be in next week either, right, boys? So I'm sort of, I miss Patrick. It's good to have him here.
There's a terrific restaurant in Kansas City called Jasper's, Jasper Mirabile. The Mirabile family started with his dad, who was born over a grocery store in Newark many years ago.
Really?
And it is a very modern, very upscale, delicious place.
Hey, you guys, we're hearing
I think we're hearing something we shouldn't be hearing. A little bonus.
But, sorry.
It's a terrific place, and Jasper Jr. is going to be at the James Beard House, I think January 11th, cooking.
Uh-huh.
He's been there in
the past.
Oh, wow,
how great. Yeah. Well, I guess we won't be going to the James Beard House, but welcome to Jasper. And I'll pass that along to Patrick, because I think he does have to go back out and do more turkey business sometime next week.
Mm-hmm.
The turkey thing, I mean, I can remember when I worked at the Broadway Butcher, the day before Thanksgiving was the absolute worst day of the year for us, not because we didn't make money. It was actually the biggest money maker of the year because turkeys are so cheap, but because people are so hysterical about the size of their turkeys. So if you ordered a turkey that was 12 to 14 pounds and it came in at 11 pounds, 12 ounces, or 14 pounds, 2 ounces, they would have a tantrum. I mean, people would literally have a meltdown in a store full of people because their turkey was 2 ounces over or under. It was mind blowing. And just goes to show you how loaded the family holidays are.
Oh my.
Because people would just hysterical. Joanna, I can tell you're like itching to tell.
Well, no, I just want to tell something very funny. And that is, two Christmases ago, my whole family gathered in Paris.
Uh-huh.
And we were going to do...
What a good idea.
Yeah, and it was a great idea, but we were going to have our Christmas dinner. And God love Ariane DeGan from D'Artagnan, who's a great friend, and I also wrote this book with her. She said, I can send you a turkey, an American turkey in Paris. Fine.
Okay.
Okay.
Sounds like a movie.
Here is a problem. Have you ever tried to cook anything? Have you ever seen French stoves?
I was just going to say, I can't imagine that there was an oven big enough in all of Paris outside of a restaurant.
Dory Greenspan said that French turkeys are like the runway models. They're long-legged and flat-chested. So
this was a problem.
So this 14.5-pound turkey, 15-pound turkey arrives, and there is a store on the Rue Saint-Paul called Thanksgiving. And I'd actually written about this woman, Judy Blyson. She and her husband have this store where they sell American products. Uh-huh. It's over in the Marais where we were staying. And they had an aluminum pan. One of those oval things?
Yeah.
So we got this aluminum pan, and with a lot of massaging, we...
and a very tight truss.
We managed to get this big bird, as it were, into the oven. My daughter pronounced it the best Thanksgiving turkey she'd ever had. It was hysterical.
She better have it.
Oh, my God. It was the funniest thing. And we did on American-style turkey and Thanksgiving fixings in Paris. And that is a challenge.
That is a challenge. Because, I mean, for one thing, yams are not exactly ubiquitous. And I don't think Brussels sprouts are even... I forget what they call them. Les petits choux, I guess, right?
Yeah, yes, les petits choux. But it was great fun. And
it's always fun to celebrate an American holiday abroad, I have to admit. I've always had a good time doing that somehow. Like, I feel more connected to my country when I can do that.
We did that. We did another one in London.
Yeah.
And I brought the cranberries in my suitcase.
Did you really?
Of course.
And nobody... Well, of course, you waltz right into...
England.
England, yeah. You waltz in with no problem. Yes, I mean, they have no issues.
Except the turkey, which had been ordered with great ceremony, long distance, transatlantic. The two turkeys were delivered to the apartment that we were renting, unplucked.
Oh, no way.
Oh, yeah. The gross feathers were gone. My son-in-law and I plucked like... forever.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Because where do you get a big enough pot to like douse it in hot water even? I mean, it's not an easy task.
No. It was a fabulous turkey. It was organic and all that other stuff.
I'm looking forward to mine. Patrick told me last night that he's sending me an 18-pound turkey. I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but...
Stop
I'll figure it out.
Stop it.
Anyway, we have to wrap things up, guys. It has been a real pleasure to welcome Joanna Pruess and Bob Laip and Rosemary Morse onto the show. Folks who are listening, take a look at our website and our tag cloud for the Griswold and Wagnerware Cast Iron Cookbook, available in bookstores all over the place. Or look for... Do you have a blog or a website?
Coming soon.
For Joanna Pruess, that's spelled P-R-U-E-S-S. Look for it and you'll see her upcoming appearances promoting this lovely new book. Thanks very much for being on the show today, folks. I hope you'll come back.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's the price that you gotta pay. Do yourself a favor.